bits of graduate school. Also, I offer a book recommendation for those interested in such things as books. It's called The Ascent of Gravity, The Quest to Understand the Force That Explains Everything by a gentleman called Marcus Chown. It is a very relaxed, easygoing discussion of some aspects of gravity that don't require any knowledge of mathematics whatsoever. It will give you some interesting ideas for some important aspects of gravity without having to deal with much in the way of odd space-time geometries, Lorentzian transforms. It's a very simple, easy, good read. So consider it and read it or not. Okay, let me drop. Just as a little what I learned this week, I came across something that I didn't know before, and I thought I might share it with you guys. I have often been disappointed in famous first words. For every that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, there tends to be a lot more, Mr. Watson, come here, I want to see you. So I recently came across a piece of history of aviation radio communications and came across this rare bit of history. In 1910, an airman, Walter Wellman, and five companions attempted to cross the Atlantic Ocean in the airship America, filled with hydrogen gas. He also was accompanied by his cat, Kiddo. Unfortunately, once they went underway, Kiddo decided he was not so fond of flying and started causing trouble by meowing, crying, and running around like a squirrel in a cage. The Airship America was the first aircraft to be carrying radio equipment, a spark gap generator with the call menu, and it had the first aerial engineer, Melvin Vanneman. He was so annoyed by the antics of Kiddo that he was moved to make the first in-flight radio transmission to his secretary back on land. The historic first message read, "Roy, come and get this goddamn cat." Let me break. Unfortunately, a few days later into this adventure, Vanneman also was famous for issuing the first aerial distress message in history. The first successful attempt to cross the Atlantic Ocean in an airship, unfortunately, took place 9 years after this attempt. It was done by the U.S. Navy Curtis NC-4 flying boat. Let me drop, and then on to the news. The really big science news for this week is, of course, that a radar instrument on a European mission to Mars has discovered liquid water beneath the red planet's solar polar cap. This didn't just show up on all the newspapers as well as news and science-oriented websites. It was part of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert's opening monologue. This new discovery indeed raises intriguing but highly speculative possibilities for both astrobiology and studies of Mars' past climate. The discovery of liquid water on Mars is believed to have huge consequences for the search for life on the red planet and might also unveil characteristics of the ancient environment in which it formed. Let me drop. We already know that Mars was once a wet planet and that its climate billions of years ago could support large amounts of liquid water, as shown by the myriad ancient river channels, floodplains, and lake beds that can be seen on its surface. Today, however, the temperature and pressure of the planet's surface is too low to suggest the existence of liquid water. In 2006, planetary scientists operating the camera on board NASA's Mars Global Surveyor observed changes in gullies that they attributed to liquid water flows. But the high-rise camera on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has since revealed that these flows are small avalanches of dry material instead. Let me drop. Then in 2011, HiRISE began to spy the seasonal appearance of dark streaks called recurring slope linea. These, too, were attributed to flows of liquid water, but recent evidence suggests that recurring slope linea are another byproduct of dry avalanches. While some have so far concluded that water does not exist on the Martian surface, Stephen Clifford of the Planetary Science Institute proposed in 1987 that liquid water could lie underneath the ice caps. However, evidence for that hidden water has eluded scientists until now. Let me drop. The subsurface liquid water was detected by the Mars Advanced Radar and Subsurface Ionosphere Sounding Instrument, called MARSIS, on board the European Space Agency's Mars Express orbiter. The water resides in a 20-kilometer or 12.4-mile wide area and is 1.5 kilometers or 1 mile beneath Planum Australis, a large plain in Mars' south polar region. The key to identifying the water is a property called dielectric permittivity. This is the measure of how an electromagnetic wave, such as a radar pulse, is attenuated as it travels through a medium. Liquid water is a much stronger attenuator and absorber of radar than ice, and the contrast in dielectric permittivity is highest at the interface between a layer of liquid water and a layer of water ice, producing a radar echo that can be detected. Let me drop. This is very similar to the idea that has been brought up on this TechNet before, that a container of liquid water heats up to a boil very quickly in a microwave oven, while its solid ice form doesn't warm up that much. The water below the ice cap must be at least tens of centimeters deep for Mars to detect it. But it is not clear whether the body of water exists as a deep lake, like, say, Lake Vostok on Earth, or as a shallow layer. In Antarctica, the water can exist because the temperatures below the kilometer-thick ice can reach the melting point. On Mars, the temperature below the ice cap are much lower, but it is thought the liquid water could instead exist as brine that would lower the freezing point of the water. Let me drop. The existence of brine on Mars is likely because of the existence of something called perchlorate salts. In 2008, NASA's Phoenix Mars lander found magnesium, calcium, and sodium perchlorate in Martian topsoil, and it has since been found to be widespread across the red planet. While the exact temperature of the discovered liquid water is unknown, laboratory experiments have shown that in some conditions, briny water can remain liquid down to 70 degrees centigrade, minus 70 degrees centigrade. Attempts to detect the water with another instrument on the MRO, the shallow radar instrument, have so far proven fruitless. The shallow radar instrument operates at a higher frequency, 15 to 25 megahertz, compared to the 5 megahertz of Mars. And the higher the frequency, the higher the attenuation of the signal. Let me drop. Researchers were extremely surprised that the shallow radar instrument did not see anything, but they believe this could be because the shallow radar instrument cannot penetrate to the depth needed to detect the liquid ice interface. Forthcoming missions to Mars will carry high-frequency radars, which is used to image ground ice. However, this latest finding could also renew an interest in lower-frequency radars to study the presence of water beneath Mars. So once again, when we land on Mars, will little green men come to greet us or throw red Martian rocks at us? Nope. Unless there's something warming up those underground bodies of water that we don't have a clue about, it's much likely that the salt content of these bodies of salt is so great that the water in our own Dead Sea would seem like drinkable distilled water by comparison. And it's much more likely that their brackish, salty water body is loaded with something isn't loaded with something as benign, say, as sodium chloride salt to us. Their salts are probably perchlorate salts. These salts can be quite toxic to most life on our planet. They make rocket fuel out of this stuff, and although they offer a great food source for some ancient extremophile microbes that have evolved to live by feeding on the exhaust of undersea volcanic vents, there isn't much life that really likes perchlorate. So Martian life, either in the deep past or less likely present, is still an unproven hypothesis. Let me drop for possible questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I have a little information about the spacecraft that found this. Would you like that?
Yes, certainly. The more the merrier.
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's called Mars Express. It's a European Space Agency mission. It's been orbiting Mars quite some time. It also has NASA type of radios on board, so you'd be able to use it to as a repeater if the other NASA satellites were having problems. But the instrument, like you said, Mars Advanced Radar for subsurface ionosphere and ionosphere, works on sending frequencies, radar transmissions down and then below the surface, and it comes back up. The band that it's working on is like really 160 close to 30 meters. Is that, you know, like what you said, 5.5, and then all the way down to 1.5 megahertz. Let me drop it. So that, you know, it's a good range. The ionosphere affects the 1.5 to around 3. So the daytime, you don't get as good as results. But most of it's doing it. Most of the of what the European Space Agency is doing is at night, because the frequency is a little bit better, all the way up to 5.5, and it penetrates the ground very good. Interesting part about the spacecraft, though, the antenna, it has on it a 40-meter, and I mean a 40-meter full tip-to-tip length antenna. So when I think about it, my 80-meter dipole in the backyard, it's really that long. Because I have a half-wave 80-meter dipole. So it's an incredibly long antenna, and it's got this unusual construction. When it all popped out, it was all folded into 13 different segments and eventually popped out successfully. They had a little problem in the beginning with the one side, but then eventually the other, that worked out, and then the other side opened up. So that's what's on it. And there's actually another smaller antenna around seven meters going in the air, 90 degrees off center. That's an amazing piece of equipment. We think of the spacecraft orbiting Mars, usually with the solar wings and, you know, the couple antennas here and there, but this thing has this massive 40-meter dipole, 20 on one side, 20 meters on the other side, sticking out of this thing. It's incredible. And the pipe size is an inch and a half. They call it 33 millimeters. So it's roughly an inch and a half diameter, pipe size. Incredible. Back to you, Roy, WS2.
Very good, Paul. You piqued my interest. I'm going to have to pull up some pictures because I had no idea. A 40-meter dipole antenna stuck on that thing. Gosh, that's a big thing to carry. Thank you very much. Anyone else with any questions, answers, statements about life on Mars and the liquid water found only a mile below surface? It's, you know, what's a mile? Just if you feel thirsty, you just bend over and you just drill for a mile, and then you still have to distill the stuff unless you want to use it for rocket fuel.
I'll send you a picture of what this thing looks like with the antenna. With the antenna extended, boy. It's incredible.
Okay, very good. I like the aspect of this particular news item that it kind of is a callback to months and months ago. Dick did a discussion of that some things just don't melt that you would think would melt in a microwave oven. Ice is not a very good dielectric in its frozen state, because the reason why water heats up is because the electromagnetic waves rotate the free fluid molecules of hydrogen dioxide, and in its solid form, it's frozen within the matrix, and it doesn't really bounce back and forth and absorb all that kinetic energy. So they use the same basic principle to find water, liquid water on Mars. That's nice. Okay, on to the next. Let's see here. The astronomers behind a universe mapping satellite have released the project's final set of processed data. Their latest result is the newest image of the oldest visible light in the universe. of microwave radiation from just a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. The European Space Agency launched the Planck satellite in 29, and the telescope finished taking data in 2013. The researchers released the first data set in 2013, another in 2015, and now the final legacy data set last week. But it doesn't answer all the remaining questions about the early universe. The Planck mission measured the microwave background to the greatest precision yet after the Big Bang. Physicists think that the universe quickly inflated, then began cooling down and slowed, though it's still expanding to this day. Light bounced around until 380,000 years ago after the Big Bang. It was 380,000 years after the Big Bang when atoms began to capture electrons, after which light traveled unimpeded until scientists measured it here on Earth. The expanding universe stretched out those light waves so much that they became microwaves. This light is visible every direction we look, and it represents the structure of the early universe. Let me drop. The cosmic microwave background light is incredibly uniform, though it looks red and blue on researchers' maps. These colors represent temperature differences of tiny fractions of a degree, a fractional difference of only about one part in 100,000 from an average temperature for the observed background radiation, averaging out to about 2.7 degrees above absolute 0 degrees Kelvin. You might wonder why Planck's scientists have released this map in 2018 when the satellite finished taking data all the way back in 2013. Well, the 2015 data set, they say, is limited because the polarization data, or data about the direction of the light waves point perpendicular to its direction of travel, was not of high enough quality. The most recent data has been reprocessed, giving scientists more confidence in the polarization and temperature data. But many questions about the polarization still remain, reports Nature. Let me drop. The cosmic microwave background is believed to offer evidence in support of the current understanding of the universe. One is believed to be full of dark matter, dark energy. It is also believed to support cosmic inflation and offer a way to measure the rate that the universe is currently expanding. The most recent measurement of this rate, the Hubble constant, was taken to be 67.4 kilometers per second per megaparsec. That means that for every 3.26 million light years in distance, that's what a megaparsec is, the universe expands another 67.4 kilometers per second, or 150,000 miles per hour. And that's just Planck's measurement, though. It doesn't match up with the other measurements taken by either Gaia satellite or the Hubble Space Telescope, which measured a Hubble constant of 73.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Let me drop. This is a major outstanding question in physics that we've mentioned before here on the Science Talk, and researchers are looking for other ways to confirm the Hubble constant, such as by measuring gravitational waves produced by the collision of two black holes that we spoke about earlier this month. Nature reports that scientists have gone to other missions, but some worry that there won't be another space-based cosmic microwave background mission too soon, given that past missions, like BICEP 2, have been unable to answer questions about inflation. There are still tons of outstanding puzzles, though the scientists worry that some expertise will be lost without researchers studying the cosmic microwave background. Let me drop for possible questions or comments. Okay, we have talked about how our nearby neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is only 2.537 million light years away, is on a collision course with our own Milky Way galaxy. But don't worry, it won't happen for another 4 billion years, so I promise you, it will not affect your life one bit. This appears to not be the first time Andromeda has crashed another galaxy's party. Andromeda seems to have a history of doing this. New research suggests that Andromeda gobbled up another large galaxy some 2 billion years ago. Let me drop. Galactic histories are rife with uncertainty and chaos, but But new models of galactic formation demonstrate that Andromeda may have undergone one big merger with another galaxy whose stars had a combined mass of around 25 billion times the mass of our own sun. This hypothetical galaxy, whose remnants exist as Andromeda's satellite galaxy called M32, would have been the third largest galaxy in our local group of galaxies. The merger would explain several observations simultaneously, according to the paper published recently in Nature Astronomy. Andromeda has a large stretched stream of stars orbiting it, separated from its spiral arms, that it's thought to originate from some collision. It also has a satellite galaxy orbiting it called M32, whose stars contain an abundance of elements heavier than hydrogen or helium. Andromeda, too, as a halo of stars with an excess of heavier elements. It also appears that a fifth of Andromeda's stars formed only 2 billion years ago, the paper reports. Let me drop. The researchers used these clues in computer simulations to model a galaxy much like Andromeda, with a similar mass and composition of stars with heavier elements. The simulation pointed to a single collision with a large galaxy 2 billion years ago, in which Andromeda sucked up the galaxy stars. The scientists call the galaxy M32P, whose corpse remains as M32. This study is just a model, and though 2 billion years is relatively recent in astronomical time, the researchers weren't there to observe the merger. So this is just the best guess. So while we can't time travel, astrophysical models will be used so that we can reveal some strange stories and potential truths about our universe's history. Let me drop for possible questions or comments. Okay, as I've mentioned before here, Mars will soon be at its closest position to Earth in the past 15 years, making the red planet appear 10 times brighter than usual. The peak proximity will occur at 3:50 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on July 31st. As Paul mentioned, because Mars is engulfed in a planet-wide sandstorm, which happens on this red planet every 6 to 8 years, there isn't that much to see with your telescope. But NASA Martian probes are following these storms closely. The fact is that scientists still don't know much about them, including why they form and how exactly they evolve. Let me drop. So for those interested in some pictures of Mars before and during the dust storms, I posted a link with some nice snapshots before and during on my website, roy.ac2gs.com. As long as I'm offering some snapshots of Mars for listeners, I thought I might throw in some recent pictures released this week of Neptune, Titan, Jupiter, and poor Pluto. They are all shown on a page that I'll offer a link to on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. Thanks to the very large telescope operated by the European Southern Observatory in northern Chile and its adaptive optics, we have the clearest image yet of Neptune. The trick is adaptive optics, which use deformable mirrors and sometimes lasers to reduce blurring to the images caused by the presence of the atmosphere. The Saturn mission of our faithful explorer Cassini lasted over a decade and sent back incredible pictures and data. Though it was intentionally crashed into the surface of Saturn last September, its data is still changing our view of the solar system. New images of Saturn's moon Titan were taken in the infrared. Cassini gathered pictures of the satellite for 13 years, and all that data has now been converted into stunning images, according to a NASA press release, representing some of the clearest, most seamless-looking global views of the icy moon surface produced so far. Let me drop. On July 15th, the Juno spacecraft, currently in orbit around Jupiter, made a close flyby of the planet and captured stunning pictures of high-altitude clouds forming in the planet's north-north belt, just below Jupiter's north polar region. Some pretty amazing images of Pluto awed the world when they were released back in 2015, but New Horizon, the spacecraft that took the images, had cameras that could see well beyond the spectrum of visual light available to us mere humans. The result were gorgeous pictures, but not pictures that matched what we'd see if we managed to fly all the way out there and gaze at Pluto with our own eyes. These images corrected and allow us, the new images correct and allow us to glimpse what Pluto might look like without false color alteration. Let me drop.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Going back to the Very Large Telescope, did you say you saw a picture of what it took of Neptune? And if that's true, is that posted on your webpage? I searched for it. I heard there's supposed to be this Neptune picture out there, but I couldn't find it. I tried Wikipedia and all the common websites and the website for the Very Large Telescope, and they have pictures, I mean, of everything, but not that. I wanted to see a side-by-side picture of Hubble. It's supposed to be out there, but, you know, with Hubble compared to the Very Large Telescope. Back to you, Eric.
Yes, Eric?
I could be wrong, but I believe on a number of the news websites, they had a picture of Hubble taking a picture of Venus and the Very Large Telescope taking a picture of Venus, and the Very Large Telescope gives you more resolution.
Yeah, but getting back to Paul's question, I have a link, and it says it's an image from the Very Large Telescope, and at the end of this little spiel, I will hit the magic button, and it will be available on the webpage.
Yeah, that's good, because it's always good when they talk about all these new telescopes, either space-borne or earth-borne telescopes, to have comparisons. You know, just to put a picture out there is no good. But that sounds good. You know, I have plenty of pictures of Hubble Neptune pictures, but if I get a picture of that, then you could compare the two and see how they're doing. They're supposed to be getting very close as far as resolution and all. So, very good. Back to you, Roy.
If I remember the article right, they have a very nice comparison of a blurry, vague, and a much sharper one. So it's not a big one. It's not a large resolution picture, but it gives you a good feel for the improvements in the imaging.
Okay, well, nothing's going to compare to Voyager 2, but that's in a class all by itself. Back to your
work. Well, you know, give it enough time and enough dollars and you'll get better results. Getting back, let's see, we talked about Jupiter's tidal forces on its moon Io, causing Io to radiate more energy per given volume than the core of our own sun. A recently obtained image of Io isn't very clear, but a red-hot image of Jupiter's moon Io also made the news this week, and it's available on my page. Io is the most volcanically active body in our solar system, gushing lava in such vast and impressive amounts that Earth's eruptive summits look positively puny by comparison. This week, researchers announced that they'd identified a potential new volcano on Jupiter's moon using infrared data collected last December by the Juno spacecraft. Let me drop for any possible comments or questions.
AC2LR?
Yes, K recognized.
I think I've asked this before, but I can't remember the answer. What is the difference between what we can see with infrared imaging versus regular light imaging?
Well, infrared is more of a thermal signature than it is anything else. So it picks up hot bodies better than the visual spectrum does. There are other bodies in space that emit more ultraviolet, although those are more stars and such. But I would assume that the major takeaway from infrared emissions are more thermal emissions than anything.
Okay, thank you. This is AC2LR.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, that's what we got to look forward to with the James Webb once that gets up now, I think 2021. And that's primarily infrared. And, you know, if you look at planets or star systems or anything with dust in anywhere in front of you, the infrared doesn't care about that dust. It's going to look right through it. And, you know, you're talking about side-by-side pictures, and if you had a regular camera on the same spacecraft, you might not see hardly anything inside of a galaxy, for instance. But the infrared will show very sharp pictures. I think that's the biggest difference. That's why they like to use it.
Yeah, but what you're really looking at is the thermal signature of the body. If it was cold, you wouldn't see much in the infrared. It's that it's warm that you see it kind of lighting up.
Oh, I agree, but I thought Kay was asking what the difference in the visual picture itself that you would see. So I thought that was the question. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you a lot, Paul. Leveraging robotics to undertake dangerous missions has obvious benefits for mankind, and space travel is no exception. In 2011, NASA sent its dexterous assistant called Robonaut 2 on a trip to the International Space Station with the objective of working alongside presiding astronauts. Now a source in the rocket and space industry says that a Russian android duo could be following suit as early as next year. According to Defense One, the Fedor androids will, in an unprecedented move, fly on the unmanned Soyuz spacecraft, not as cargo, but as crew members. The Roscosmos Space Agency has reportedly given the flight its preliminary approval. Fedor is an application of Final Experimental Demonstration Object Research and refers to a 2014 program that aimed to create a robot capable of replacing humans during high-risk scenarios such as rescue missions. The androids have been endowed with a number of abilities, including driving, doing push-ups, lifting weights, and even shooting firearms. Former Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin then had to deny that Russia was trying to create a Terminator robot. Let me drop. With rapid developments in the AI arena, the question of whether it will be used for destructive or benevolent purposes is always on the table. But Rogozin assured that Fedor would have great practical significance in various fields. Backing up those comments, associate research analysts pointed out that despite its military-ready build, Fedor was designed primarily to function in space from the very beginning. So my question is, are Fedor right to fire off by the Second Amendment, and if they're powered in any way by vodka, and finally, do our future robot overlords deserve a ticker tape parade when they return home, and how will we pay in the end if we fail to give them one? Let me drop for any possible comments or questions.
Now I understand something, Roy, WS to it.
What is that, Paul?
Now I know why this made it to the news. I mean, I saw this on multiple websites and a couple of TV. I think Channel 2 had it. The United States has sent three different types of robots to the space station already. You know, we sent Robonaut 2 up there, like you said. Unfortunately, they had some problems with that. Eventually, they couldn't repair it. They sent the torso up, the top part up. And then years later, they sent the legs up, and they tried to get the astronauts to connect it to. And they had all kinds of real electronic problems that they couldn't deal with, you know. So they sent the whole thing back on a SpaceX Dragon spacecraft. But, I mean, it was doing good for a while. There's videos of this thing moving around and doing stuff. But then there's two other ones. There's Dextra, which is on the outside of the International Space Station. It's big. It's like, you know, 12 feet high and about 12 feet wide. Let me drop it. And that's been active for years. It's been changing out batteries, you know, 400-pound battery packs. It's done a lot of work with TV cameras and moved things around. It's operated mostly by the ground, but, you know, the crew can operate it as well. But Houston actually operates Dextra most of the time, so when the crew is sleeping, this thing is out there doing things. And it's attached to the Canadian robot arm, and they could move it all over the station. So that's that. You know, it's actually done tests on refueling and all of that. Taking caps off, cutting wires. Got a toolkit. So, you know, we've been doing it. And now there's another one on board right now called Simon. That's looks like a gigantic beach ball, and that floats through the. Through the cabin of the ISS and responds to the astronauts, and they talk to it, and it's got artificial intelligence. But the reason, and now I can see the reason, let me drop it, is because this fact that apparently this thing is shooting guns, that I haven't heard. I get it. Back to you, Roy, WS1.
Yeah, I thought it was an amusing little piece, and, you know, I don't know if it really is a good idea to teach robots how to shoot, but whatever. I think that ultimately this is the short-term solution to the enormous problem that we're not evolved for zero or low gravity over protracted periods of time, and that probably the first few semi-robotic manned missions to Mars, if they go off, are probably going to be one-way things. So much rather leave a robot behind than a human being. So I think, although it's not going to get as much PR buzz as a real American, you know, red-blooded guy or woman, I think that's probably a good idea to work on artificial human beings that don't have to deal with gravity problems.
Yeah, I know. If Robonaut 2 worked out, it was going to operate, do stuff in the space station. Actually, it did to some extent, but not everything they planned on it doing it. And once it had its legs, and the legs had, like, claws on the bottom, it could grab things. The idea was to eventually push this thing out of the Quest Air lab. But that's the airlock where astronauts do spacewalks. They were going to have this thing going outside and doing work that the crew were, you know, you'd be able to cut back on the EVAs, but they never got that far. But they're working on it. This Robonaut 2, that early version of this thing, had a head and a whole bit, torso, body, was built by GM, General Motors, and now they're working on it, trying to work out the bugs, and they plan on eventually sending it back up. We'll see. Then we'll have competition between the Russian robots and our American Robonaut, and Robonaut 2. I guess they'll call it Robonaut 3.
People will complain about an android gap.
I get it, yeah. Instead of the space race, we're going to have the android, the robot race.
Oh, it's always something. What can you do? I think it's a reasonable thing to look into, because that seems to be the simplest solution to a lot of organic, biological limitations of human beings. So as long as they don't really train it to just shoot with great alacrity, I'm all for the program.
Very good. So they'll be probably sending this thing. I wonder if they'll send it actually up on a crewed Soyuz spacecraft, these two robots. You know, they have two spacecraft that go up, the Russians and the Soyuz crewed version and the Progress version, which is the cargo version. I wonder which one will go up on. They're going to send it up on a crewed version and have the door open up and have these things climb through the hatchway. This is unbelievable. When are they going up?
No not quite sure. I don't really recall. They don't have a date yet. They have a approval by Roscosmos, so they don't have any set dates. It's more of an agreement to start the wheels in motion. But the way that it was mentioned was that it's not going to be a crewed cargo. It's going to be an uncrewed cargo where the robots or the androids will be the crew. So I don't know if it means that they're going to put the two robots in by themselves in a crewed vessel, or just they're playing linguistic games.
Okay, I'll put a pin in this. I'll watch for this in the future. Very good, Roy. I love it. WS2N.
Okay, the last page of the August 2018 issue of Scientific has a very nice graphic display of a recorded history of sunspot activity and different types of cycles that are longer and not quite as known as the cycle that's operating on our sun. And I put that up already on the page if you want to take a look at it. It's a simple illustration of centuries of data about sunspot cycles and how the different cycles are supposedly being mapped. I think it requires a great deal of imagination to see those cycles being cyclical, but, you know, take a look yourself. The sun's pockmarked surface has always been shifting. Sunspots and solar flares rise and fall every 11 years, a cycle associated with regular reversals of the star's magnetic field. Huge quantities of plasma, known as coronal mass ejections, fly into space, which can disrupt satellites and other electronic signals if they reach Earth. More solar activity during that cycle also amplifies auroras and warms Earth's temperature slightly. And for we few, we happy few, we band of brothers and sisters, it means our magic bands wake up and let us listen and speak to the world. Some careful study has shown that longer periodicities may exist as well. There's something called a Gleisberg cycle, first identified in 1862, which says that the cycle strengthens and weakens the 11-year cycle over the course of a century. One paper posited that the Gleisberg pattern is caused by a slow swaying of the sun's magnetic pole. There is the Seuss-Debris cycle, which is said to last about 200 years, whereas there's a Hallstatt cycle, they say, which runs on the order of 2,400 years. Still, the sun can also be more erratic than any of the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This particular article is behind a paywall. So, as I said, I cannot offer you the article, but I can offer you the illustration. And if you're a Scientific American subscriber, feel free to thumb to the end of the magazine and read it. And if you're not, you maybe should consider to subscribe. Those magazines are really... are feeling the pain, and they're going out of business, and the only thing that's going to keep them afloat is people who subscribe. So if you borrow your friends' magazines, you're not going to have very long to read those magazines, unfortunately. So consider subscribing to magazines you like to read. Let me drop for any comments or questions. Okay, there has been great interest on this TechNet in the Amateur Radio Parity Act called H.R. 555. As mentioned some time ago, some people caution that it's not quite the panacea that some amateurs hope that it might have been. Years earlier, a large homeowners alliance organization imposed upon Congress to modify the wording just a bit before they'd stop opposing it. These differences may or may not serve as a basis for legal loopholes that you may be able to operate a tri-element 80-meter Yagi through. Time will only tell. In this Congress, the Amateur Radio Parity Act actually made it out of House Committee four times already, which is very important for a bill to become law. Let me drop. Unfortunately, it had to get through the Senate Committee as well. And the Democratic Senator of Florida, a guy named Bill Nelson, seems to keep blocking it from being released out of the Senate Committee. Now, some members of Congress thought it would be a great idea to append the Amateur Radio Parity Act to a recent Defense Authorization Act. Nested within that, the Amateur Radio Parity Act would kind of sneak through both houses and become law. Except for good old Senator Bill Nelson, who had other ideas. You see, the House of Representatives included the Amateur Radio Parity Act into their copy of the Defense Authorization Act, but the Senate didn't. when bills are different in the two houses of Congress. Representatives meet in something called a House-Senate conference to bring both copies together into a single form. The Senate Armed Services Committee ranking member was one of the big four who would have had to agree to keep the Parity Act in the final conference report, but unfortunately he deferred to good old Senator Nelson on the matter. So the legislation is stalled again, and based upon Senator Nelson's consistent dislike for it, I would say that it has any chance in 2018. But who knows? Senator Nelson's up for re-election this November, so anything is possible, but some things are more likely than other things. Let me drop. Either way, the Congress will have to start from scratch, starting with the 116th session of Congress, which is going to come 2019. They had their chance with the 115th session of Congress, which was from 2016 to 2018, but laws that aren't passed, that are still sitting around, simply expire and have to be reintroduced. So maybe next time we'll pass a bill with better chance of helping hams, but who knows? We'll see. Let me drop for any possible questions or comments.
Roy, do we have any idea what Nelson's got against this bill?
General assumption, the way I've heard it, is that although major homeowner associations kind of gave a grudging okay to the changed wording of it, some other associations are not quite happy, and they tend to donate to his reelection.
WS2M.
Yes, Paul.
I'll have to read more about the Parity Act, but it's a footnote. Bill Nelson is a senator. At one time, he was a congressman. When he was a congressman back in the 80s, he flew on the space shuttle. He was one of the politicians. They chose to go for a ride on that thing when it seemed quite safe. You know, these are the days before Challenger. Just as a footnote. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, there's a picture of him doing that in his Wikipedia entry. I looked it up when I first started to hear his name in relation to the lack of a Parity Act, trying to figure out exactly what his angle was.
Yeah, well, okay, it sounds like politics is holding that up. Very good. And by the way, the other guy was from Utah, gone, Senator gone. He was a senator at the time. But what NASA wanted, they needed somebody from the House of Representatives, and they needed somebody from the Senate, and they picked those two guys. They flew on different flights. Senator Nelson did great. Senator gone, he got so sick. We talked about that many times. He got so sick, he was always throwing up, and he just couldn't handle it. So they actually refer to him. You know, it's become a verb. You know, you've gone. he had problems, but both are officially astronauts. They both went up.
All for putting politicians in rockets and launching them into space. I see it as a win-win proposition.
Yeah, now we just got to get this parity thing passed. Okay, back to you, Roy.
Hey, just as a precautionary tale, it does have loopholes. It's not quite black and white. It'll probably spend a lot of years in courts kind of redefining what it really means and what rights it gets, but we'll see what happens. Talking about politics, the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology has concluded a two-day hearing focused on trying to understand how the James Webb Space Telescope, NASA's flagship telescope project, could have gone from a 2007 planned launch with a $500 million budget all the way to a 2021 launch with a $9.6 billion budget. Let me drop. The James Webb Space Telescope promises to be a Hubble's incredible successor. It will sit at L2, a gravitational stable point a million miles from Earth, where the telescope can maintain the same position relative to our planet and the sun. Its budget has repeatedly ballooned, and its launch date has been pushed back several times as the project's goals became more and more ambitious and unexpected issues turned up. Most recently, testing setbacks with a healthy portion of human error have pushed the projected launch date from May 2020 to March 2021. The project will require yet another $800 million. Let me drop. Much of the budget overruns come from over-optimism related to the project, but Congressman Lamar Smith, chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, laid the blame for some of the most discussed of these human errors on NASA's contractor, Northrop Grumman. In one case, the company used the wrong solvent to clean valves in the telescope thrusters, destroying some equipment. Congressman Smith said that the lack of individual safety checks led to problems and errors that didn't appear until testing. A recent independent review board led by a former director of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Tom Young, recently released a report with a series of recommendations for the team to look for other potential errors, perform testing, and complete the project. Let me drop. Northrop Grumman CEO Wes Bush said that Northrop Grumman would adhere to the recommendations in the independent review. Additionally, he said that all payments already received and to be received in the future for this contract would be placed into a holding account and would only be released to his company if the mission is successful. But when Smith asked what Northrop Grumman's 2017 profits were to the nearest $1 billion, Bush would not really say. Apparently, someone looked it up. It's $2.015 billion, which is a nice change. When Congressman Smith asked if Northrop Grumman would pay the $800 million that the project is expected to go over, Bush said basically he would not. NASA maintains some of the responsibility for the project's changing plans. We can blame the contractor, but it is on us to have mission success, the NASA director Jim Bridenstine said at the hearing. Despite these challenges, members of Congress are clearly still excited about the flagship mission, with several expressing their eagerness to show the world what American science can do. Let me drop. Many were sympathetic to just how much science has changed. Astronomers have found thousands of exoplanets since the project's, and the mysteries of dark matter and dark energy have only deepened. Still, several remained angry about the project. Congressman Dana Rohrabacher asked about whether there were possible penalties for Northrop Grumman and suggested these delays be taken into account as NASA is assessing future contracts. Others asked that future project plans include better stopgaps so the errors are noticed before integrated testing. NASA is also grappling with the effect of these budgetary overruns. At the recent hearing, NASA Director Bridenstine said that there were discussions, but not decisions, as to how James Webb Space Telescope will end up cannibalizing other missions. He mentioned delaying the upcoming Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope as a possibility, but said that the needed funding would not come from human spaceflight endeavors. Let me drop. There's still plenty of work to do before that will hopefully be March 2021 launch. Bridenstine mentioned 300 potential points of failure that will require testing and an optimistic schedule. And since the telescope is going to be at L2 rather than orbiting close to Earth, you can't really easily go back and fix it if something goes wrong. That's the way Hubble needed to be fixed after its own deployment. Still, despite the huge cost and discouraging delays, it's going to be an incredible telescope. It just needs to get off the ground first. Let me drop for questions or comments. Okay, guys, it's 11:04. It's time for the space report. I will, though, once again say that if you want to see any of the articles that are linked to any of the subjects that I mentioned, it's on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. And or if you want to send me any comments, questions, answers, statements, rebuttals, what have you, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Thank you very much for listening, and over to you, Paul, for the space report.
Okay, very good. And I don't know if Dick wanted to make any comments first. If not, I'll just pick it up. Okay. KQRI, WW West Atlantic.
Please proceed, Paul.
Thanks, Dick. I'm going to try something that Roy always tries, but sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not. Today's July 29th. What happened 60 years ago, 60 years ago today? Anybody have a guess? You're allowed to cheat. Anybody got a computer? You're allowed to cheat. I guess not. Eisenhower signed the final paper, which started NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So this is the anniversary of that. And it's been going ever since. They needed something to advance the sciences without having something to do with the military. Although NASA agreed that as time went on, if they discovered anything that or invented anything that would be useful for the military, they would be allowed to have it. They also agreed that everything would be all open source. They didn't have that word back then, but that's essentially what happened. You go to a NASA website, and you can read all the intricate things that they've done over the years. And there's also no commercials, no advertisements on that. So, very good. That's the 60-year anniversary of NASA. So, here we are all these years later. We've been to the moon. We've gone to all the planets, visited with them. With the robotic spacecraft, we have two spacecraft that are still functioning, leaving the solar system. A couple of other ones that have left the solar system but are not functioning. And that's the story. Over 500 people have been into space, and a lot more to come, hopefully. WS2N, let me drop it for a second. Okay, with that, there's a couple of launches that took place last week. An Ariane 5 launched four satellites at one time. They're called Galileo Navigation Satellites. So essentially, it's the European Space Agency's version of the Global Positioning Satellite. So they launched a bunch of these in the past, and they launched four more on an Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana. Kourou, French Guiana, down in South America. And that was a successful launch, and it was the 99th flight of an Ariane 5 rocket. So that's many, many flights, and that's why NASA chose Ariane 5 for the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope that Roy was just talking about now in 2021. They'll be launching out of French Guiana on an Ariane 5 rocket. And hopefully they don't have any more delays. 2021 sounds like a long way away from now. Also last week there was another Iridium launch by SpaceX. Launched out of Vandenberg, California. They launched 10 more satellites, each one weighing about 2,000 pounds. They've done this quite a few times over the last couple of years, and I think they have one or two more to do. So that was a successful launch. I believe it was the fourth launch of their final version, the Block 5. The Block 5 launch vehicle, the Falcon 9. They need to launch a total of seven before NASA considers these things safe to actually put a crew on board. You know, they've had maybe four different versions of the Falcon rocket over the years. This was their final version. And this will be the version that crews will be flying to the International Space Station. Hopefully that's soon. We'll have to wait and see. They are going to pick a crew August 3rd. Brian Ensign, the new NASA director, will be making that announcement on the 3rd of tomorrow. I was going to say this month, the 3rd of August. And they're going to pick two astronauts to fly on the Dragon crew vehicle. And they're going to name two astronauts that are going to fly on the Boeing Starliner, CST-100. That's also being developed. Two people for now. Eventually that number will go up to...